Amazing.
Sibilance is like the like hissy sort of like sounds in someone's voice. Sibilance. You know?
Sibilance. Can I just say, you boys are looking handsome today.
I'm looking.
Oh, squabbered.
You boys are looking dapper today.
Thank you. I shaved yesterday, so that must be that.
That's why. And Jack's...
I didn't shave.
Jack,
I showered.
You really do just work that mustache, though.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you.
Coming through strong.
You're too kind, Squab. You're too kind.
Yeah, for some reason, I look like I have a man bun right now, but I don't. I just wore a hat all day.
Okay, yeah.
Don't I?
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, kind of. Your hair's more matted than normal.
it's longer on top than it usually is, I feel like.
Yeah, and I just got a haircut like 2 days ago, so.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, like, you know, that's what it is. It's very tight. You got a tight fade on the side, but that length on the top, in a way, where, it just kind of looks pulled back like you got, like, a man bun, which you, like, got, like, the Viking thing going on for a second there.
Yeah, now it's just crazy.
Now you just look like an idiot.
You need it to be rougher, like it was, done with rock shears or something. What, Bob, what can't you look at?
I was gonna say, you can't look at this podcast because it's an audio medium. So what are we talking about today?
Yeah, and obviously right now you're staring blankly into an open fire because it's the 1800s. And you're listening to your paws tell a story.
Podcast.
Brain-boggled fireside.
You're listening to your podcast.
The original podcast, Grandpa talking in front of an open flame.
And Grandpa's like 40 years old because that's how old Grandpas were back then.
Bobby, we know that's not true.
I know, it's the whole newborns, infancy, death brought the age
average
down.
Well, I mean, you could be a grandpa at 40 still. There was a lot of, younger, people were having kids younger.
You know what, Jack? Just but fair. Just but fair statement. I'll give you that.
Thank you.
Just but fair.
But we're not talking about any of that today. We should probably introduce ourselves.
Oh, yes.
Oh, shoot. Who am I? What am I doing here?
I'll start us off since it's my episode. I am your Brooklyn Bridge Brent.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I can finally use this one. I think I've used it before, but I'm your Jingoist Jack.
Nice.
I'm your I'm so bad at this now. Oh no. Okay, wait, I got this. I am your being able to trick people, Bobby. I don't know.
I was gonna say factory.
Oh, that would have been good, but I'm not smart enough for that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what that word means. I just know it's a word, maybe.
It's a great word. I don't know if it's applicable to this because I don't know exactly what it means, but great word, Jack.
I think it means lenses, you know, like bifocal.
Oh, bifactory. Or like olfactory senses. It's like your bifactory senses. That's definitely
Maybe I'm just combining a bunch of words. Anyway.
Listen, we're about to fool your bifactory senses because we're talking grifters today, boys.
Grifting 101.
Yes, Grifting 101. We're talking about some famous grifters from history because, I don't know, I wanted to have a fun episode to start the year off, you know.
Snake oil salesman.
Yeah, exactly. Last year, I think we started us off on doomsday prophecies. Yeah. So I just figured let's start it maybe a little bit lighter this year. Boys, I think this is the year of the scam. I'm going to just call it right now. Mm. This episode's coming out in 2022. I'm gonna call this the year of the scam. What's your scamming, boys?
Of the scam. Oh,
2021 was the year of was the gaslighting year, and 2022 is gonna be the scam year.
Yeah, and speaking of the new year, I just wanted to mention that we have new products on the store. All you got to do is email me your social security number, your credit card information, and we'll send it to you. You don't have to know what the product is.
Yes, and then if you could just get a money order that you send to this P.O. box to help my cousin who is right now stuck in Uganda because of a visa issue.
Oh, is this going to be a segue? Is this a segue?
I'm not part of this. I'm not part of
it. It's not like a direct segue per se. Didn't get the hints based on everything we literally just said up to now. We're talking about scams, grifters, particularly some like particularly fun scams from history and grifts.
It's a fun scam, see?
Yeah, exactly. Now you're getting it, Squabbert. Let's jump right in with probably one of the most famous grifters of all time, because you probably know his name and you don't even actually realize that you know it. And it's one Charles Ponzi, which you're probably
familiar.
I thought you were going to say like Robert Grift or something.
Yeah. Robert the Grift.
Inventor of the Grift.
Joseph Scamzaroomzy.
You know, I did not actually realize that Ponzi Scheme was named after
Ponzi.
John Ponzi.
Yeah, let's call him John.
Charles Ponzi.
Yeah. So, ironically enough, Charles Ponzi is not the actual inventor of the Ponzi scheme. This idea has actually existed for a long time, but he was sort of like did it in like probably like one of the most bold and like successful fashions that the whole idea of this sort of scam kind of got named after him.
He perfected it. He popularized and perfected it.
Absolutely. So this, Charles Ponzi was an Italian immigrant who moved to America. Or moved to Canada and then the U.S. and was, you know, one of history's most famous swindlers. He had aliases including Charles Ponchi. I like that. That's kind of
that
full
real clever.
Ponchi. Yeah. Carlo, you know.
I like that.
Yeah, he's going for the Beyonce, Madonna vibe back in the 1920s. And also Charles P. Bianchi. I think it actually should be Bianchi because it's Italian. So, but it's a CH, but I'm pretty sure it's Bianchi. But anyway, in case, before we go into this guy's whole story, what's first, I guess, for people who maybe don't know what a Ponzi scheme is, like you may have heard the word, but you don't know actually what it means. Let's just define what a Ponzi scheme is real quick.
I have no idea what a Ponzi scheme is.
You know, like I had like vague notions of it, but I didn't know exactly what it meant. I kind of thought it was like, oh, you know, it's like a pyramid scheme, but it's actually a little bit different.
I don't know how it's different from a pyramid scheme at all.
Yeah, it's subtle, but there is a bit of a difference. So, a Ponzi scheme is a fraudulent investing scam promising high rates of return with little risk to investors. A Ponzi scheme is a fraudulent investing scam which generates returns for early investors with money taken from the later investors. So basically, early investors bought in, like, oh, give me this money and you're going to get these high rates of return. And then in the meantime, the Ponzi schemer is also trying to recruit new investors and then using the money that those new investors give to actually pay back the original investors their quote-unquote interest.
And this just keeps going and going and going.
Going and going and going. So
it's not a pyramid scheme, Brent. It's a reverse funnel system. It's a difference. There's a difference.
Yeah, right.
Oh, so the idea with that is you just hope to keep the game running.
Yeah, you basically try to just keep the game running for as long as you can until eventually the new investors dry up and it all kind of falls apart.
Yeah, until something runs out of steam and you
damn it.
Yeah, and you go to jail for
fraud. I just lost the game, guys. Oh.
Here's the funny thing with the Ponzi scheme. It rarely works out for the Ponzi schemer. Usually by the end of it, it tends to fall apart because of the very nature. Yeah,
at least
so,
with the pyramid scheme, there's at least like a semblance of, I guess that's why pyramid schemes are still around and Ponzi schemes aren't really anymore.
Yeah, because the pyramid scheme has sort of like built-in infrastructure to sort of keep the money funneling to the top while everyone at the bottom is just working for the money and not getting any of it. Whereas the Ponzi schemer is just taking the new people's money and just giving it to the people at the top. And then being like, okay, we need to recruit more people so we can keep giving away that money.
A pyramid scheme is technically generating value somewhere.
Yeah, whereas, it's just all at the top.
Yeah. Whereas a Ponzi scheme is just moving money around.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Cutco or like that knife things, right?
That's like multi-level marketing, which is basically a pyramid scheme. But yeah, so this is similar to a pyramid scheme in that both are based on using new investor funds to pay for earlier backers. So that's the main similarity, like we just discussed. But anyway, so both Ponzi schemes and pyramid schemes eventually bottom out when the flood of new investors dries up and there isn't enough money to go around. At this point, the scheme unravels, kind of like what I was just saying earlier. Oh, so boy. That's basically how we can define a Ponzi scheme at this point. So let's actually talk about one Charles Ponzi himself. So, like I said, Charles Ponzi was an Italian immigrant who originally moved to Canada and then eventually to the U.S. He started out kind of like in Canada, running sort of like small time, sort of weird grifts and stuff, but kind of quickly kind of like ran out of luck up there and kind of had to move out of Canada as like kind of shit was hitting the fan for him and he was kind of pulling some shady stuff. So he found himself in Boston, Massachusetts, of all places, actually. So
my hometown.
Yeah, he's local boy. Local boy done bad.
Hey, local man ruins everything.
Yeah. So one Charles Ponzi set up a small office at 27 School Street in Boston in the summer of 1919, attempting to sell business ideas to contacts in Europe. So basically, he's just like... trying to hustle out there.
I know that he's like pitching investment ideas to them, but when you said sell business ideas, I imagine he's got like a sign out front that's like bricklaying business.
Yeah,
you know, I've got it all.
A sign. Yeah.
And he's like, I've got it all set up. And they're like, oh, and someone comes up and they're like, you lay bricks? And he's like, no. I'll sell the bricklaying business to you. You know, he's like, don't like that. I got a bakery business. He's got him ready to go and be sold. You know?
It's like the freaking Cat in the Hat, dude.
See,
he's
that is
pulled businesses out of his butt.
That is the true level of late stage capitalism that that's like the litmus test. We're not actually at late stage capitalism yet because we're not actually selling businesses. You know,
yeah.
Everyone's like, oh my God, cryptocurrency, you know, the privatization of currency. That's so late stage capitalism. No. We need to start selling the business, the capital generation itself.
It's like, oh, you want a business? Well, you got to go to Amazon's business inventory. We'll see what businesses are available for you to buy right now.
I'm going to start shipping out the business.
Sorry, we're fresh out of linen businesses right now. I'm so sorry. You can't have that kind of business right now.
They're hot right now.
This is a dystopian look into the future, guys. I don't like this.
Yeah.
Because I could very much see this being a thing.
Yeah, you just run the business for a while. Anyway. Yeah. He's selling things to Europe.
He's key word here being attempting to sell business ideas to contacts he has in Europe. I don't know how successful he is doing this. I would say not very, but over the course of doing this, he received a letter from a company in Spain asking about the advertising catalog, which included an international reply coupon known as an IRC, leading Ponzi to find a weakness in the system, which gave him an opportunity to make money. So there's basically like these like weird international reply coupon things that are being advertised in this catalog that Ponzi was pushing. And then the Spanish company was just like, hey, can you maybe like do something with these like international reply coupons for us? And then he was like, huh, what's an international reply coupon? Let me look into this. And then he kind of has this aha moment where he's like, wait a second, I think I can exploit this. So international postal reply coupons allow a person in one country to pay for the postage of a reply to a correspondence in another country.
Oh, it's like when you get those letters that are like prepaid postage or whatever.
Yeah, basically. So, so it allows the person in one country to pay for the postage of a reply to the thing sent in another country.
It's like a collect call for a payphone or something.
Yeah, kind of. Like collect calls before phones were a thing. So IRCs were priced at the cost of postage in the country of purchase, but could be exchanged for stamps to cover the cost of postage in the country where redeemed.
God, he's doing a currency exchange gambit, but with postage. That's so funny.
Yes. So if these values were different, there was a potential for profit. So Ponzi claimed that the net profit of these transactions after expenses and exchange rates was in excess of 400% rate of return.
Oh my God. That ain't bad.
Yeah, so this is what is considered a form of arbitrage. Arbitrage, I might be saying that wrong. So apologies if I am. Or profiting by purchasing an asset at a lower price in one market and immediately selling it in a market where the price is higher, which was and is still considered completely legal. So technically what he's doing here is not illegal for him to do or to attempt to do.
I'm gonna say, it just sounds like capitalism.
Yeah, pretty much. So like he just found like this like weird loophole where I was like, oh well, I could just buy these like weird like collect call stamps in one country and just resell them in the US where they're worth more and
yeah,
get that buku dinero, baby. So seeing an opportunity, Ponzi quit his job as a translator and to set his IRC scheme in motion, but needed a large capital outlay to buy IRCs at cheaper European currencies. So Ponzi set up a stock company to raise money from the public, I should say.
Funny. I think I know where this is going.
Yeah. So he also went to several of his friends in Boston and promised that he would double their investments in 90 days. So Ponzi later shortened this to 45 days at 50% interest, thus doubling investments in 3 months. In an environment when banks were paying only around 5% annual interest on, you know, money put in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's, you know, coming to his boys and be like, boys, listen to what I'm saying.
Boys, your money. This guy, okay, not only is this guy is the original drop shipper. This guy is the original crypto bro. This guy is
exactly.
Like, listen, your cash money is losing value sitting in those bank accounts with that 5% interest. That's literally less than inflation. All right? Losing value. Okay? If you like those guys who are like just trying to convince you so they can pump and dump. Like that's literally what this guy is.
This
is
some Wall Street Bets shit right here, but like fucking analog style.
Yeah, dude. It's human nature, man.
Hell yeah. So the great returns available from, you know, these IRCs, he explained to them, made such incredible profits so easy. Some people invested and were paid off as promised, receiving $750 interest on initial investments of $2,500. $1,250. So let's fast forward to January of 1920. Ponzi started his own company called the Securities Exchange Company.
So now, is this the equivalent of like, you know, when you say, I'm going to buy like a piece of toilet paper, a roll of toilet paper in the US for a dollar and sell it for like 16 pesos in like Mexico? Is that like, it's the same value, right? Like you're not actually gaining any value.
No. I think he technically is gaining value because it's not.
He is gaining value?
Yeah. Because a stamp in France costs a dollar versus a stamp in the US costs $5. So what he's doing is he's buying. So since he can pay for the American's postage in France, right? Mm. He can buy two stamps for $2 and send a stamp to the US and then sell that stamp for $5.
So
he can make $3 profit on every stamp.
Yeah. The important thing to remember about this whole like IRCs thing is that they work like internationally. So they're usable in the US in the same way that they're usable in Europe, as in Asia, South America.
It's the exact same reason why cryptocurrencies are so popular right now.
Right. So the fact that you can use it anywhere, but it has different values based on where you're buying it,
right,
is what makes this like such a, like a particularly, you know, like flawed system that can be exploited in this way.
There was the flaw. It's why there are like fees on currency exchanges and stuff.
Right.
So I think the funny thing is, I'm thinking about it now, not that I know this is true, this is all speculation on my part, I would not be surprised if the Security Exchanges Commission found its origins in this, because this is basically like a weird securities exchange like fraud system. So they're like, oh, well, we can't let that happen again. So let's take this thing from this guy, and now we're going to make it into the thing that tries to prevent this from happening.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, so in the first month of this, 18 people invested in his new SEC company with a total of $1,800 at the time, which was a lot of money back in 1920. He paid them promptly the very next month with the money obtained from the newer set of investors, like I said. So here is where the Ponzi scheme gets off and rolling. So Ponzi sets up a larger office this time in the Niles building on School Street in Boston. Word starts to spread, and investments increase rapidly as people are like, oh my God, did you hear about this SEC? I just gave this guy $700, and within a month, now I have like $1,200. This is wild.
That's hilarious. That's the SEC. And
people are getting rich. We're getting rich fast here, boys. What are we doing? So, say hi to your mother for me. All right, we're in Boston.
Why are we Mark Wahlberg?
I'm the great great grandfather of Mark Wahlberg. not really.
Mark, whatever you do, don't beat up a blind Vietnamese guy.
Yeah, just don't do it. Don't do it. And don't wrap in your underpants, because you'll never be able to let that shit down.
No, actually, you know what? Definitely wrap in your underpants.
Okay, yeah, sure. Come on. Yeah, you know, Mark, calm down about that. You know, you should be thanking your lucky stars that the Funky Bunch let you do that.
Yeah, Mark, a.k.a. Victor Sullivan, get out of here.
But so anyway, back to the Ponzi shit. Ponzi hired agents and paid them generously. Paid them generous commissions for each dollar they brought in. Between February and March of 1920, the total amount invested had risen from $5,000 to $25,000, which in today's money would be about between $60,000 to $320,000, respectively. As the scheme grew, Ponzi hired agents to seek out new investors throughout New England and New Jersey. At that time, investors were being paid interest rates, which subsequently encouraged others to invest, and so on and so forth. By May of 1920, he had made up to $420,000, which in today's money would be about $5.4 million.
I just got that you said nice. It took me a minute.
Yeah, sorry. Because 420, nice. and then by June of 1920, people had invested as much as $2.5 million in Ponzi's scheme, which in today's money is like $32 million.
Wow!
So by July, he was raking in $1 million per week and rising. And by the end of July, he was approaching $1 million per day.
Wow.
So this is like Ponzi scheme kept getting huger and huger and huger to the point where in 1920 dollars, there's $1 million a day coming in. Like,
dude, imagine
crazy.
You getting $1 million a day. What do you even? Yeah. You can't spend
I mean, even
that.
In today's money, imagine getting $1 million
I know,
a day.
Dude, in the 20s, that must have been like, I can't, dude. $1 million a day, that's somebody, I don't even know what it you would
just feels like
all that.
It just feels like Catch Me If You Can or something. Like, it just feels like living the good life for like a very brief period of time.
When you hear about like those you know, like insane drug lord houses that were found, and they just have billions of dollars in cash in their like walls and in their basements, and they're like, yeah, authorities found like $10 billion in cash that was just eaten by rats and rotted away or whatever. It's just absurd. Like, he must have just had just like that much, like, you ain't got a credit card in the 20s. You got to spend that cat. Well, I guess you could write a check.
Isn't it a weird thought to think that you could just like find money? And it's like, by itself, it just has no value. Like, in a world where, like, let's say, like, you know, a Last of Us style world where everything goes to like shit, this piece of paper does nothing. But if you find it here, it's like, yeah, you're just rich now. You found this thing, and now you're just rich because it means you're rich. Like, that's what it means now. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's, you know, you say that, but it's also like, it's sort of on the flip side of that, it's a hard copy of a value that somebody had contributed
at one point,
in,
yeah,
at one point in time, you know, yeah. and so now you're just that. You can sort of see it as that way, but it's also just like
you're inheriting the value.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like there's the whole debate of like whether or not, you know, what even does that mean. But that is a very interesting point that you can just be like, oh yeah, this is now mine, and now I am now very powerful in the terms of the most important thing in the history of mankind.
Yeah, it's like it's like, is there a tax on like finding money? I think there is finding treasure tax.
I think there is a treasure hunting tax, essentially.
That's hilarious. My cousin, this just reminds me of like the modern day version of like finding a sack of money. My cousin went into his crypto account and it said he had like $2 million worth of crypto. It was clearly a glitch.
Oh yeah. I had friends who experienced that glitch too.
Right. It's like so.
It said they had like several $1 trillion.
So like you move a couple decimals in the system. Like if you're talking like Dogecoin, something that's not actually a blockchain, theoretically you could just like sell that and you're just suddenly rich, like just because a decimal point moved.
I know. I mean, I've been doing a lot of money, a lot of working, right? So I've been thinking about money, you know, while I'm working, because I'm like thinking about the value of my time and all that. Mm. And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, what if like the government just put out like a PSA that was like, you know, Joe Biden was like, all right, Jack, listen, Jack, we're gonna print a bunch of money, but we're all gonna be real cool about it. We're all gonna promise not to do inflation. All right. Like, why can't we all just, you know, all pinky promise real hard not to do inflation, you know, and just print a bunch of money out.
Come on, man.
Like, we don't want this money. Like, it's going to be good for everybody. Just don't you dare raise the price of that bread or milk or anything.
Yeah, it just reminds me of the story when I was like down at the pool with John Boy and Skippy.
You know, I'm thinking about when I was a
switchblade fight.
You know, my mom, she used to give me a quarter. She used to go down to the movie theater. I want to be able to give my kids a quarter and have them go down to the movie theater too. So let's all stop doing inflation, Jack. Come on.
Now, in the same vein, you could also theoretically say, you know, how they say that the national debt is all just like tax money owed to the American citizens. We could all just decide to erase national debt. We could just be like, you know what, government, you're good.
Well, yeah, it's don't like worry about the national, it. You know, it's like, who's the debt to?
It's
you know?
Us. We could just all collectively be like, we're good. All of a sudden, America is a superpower again.
I mean, I don't know how the national debt works, but in my mind, how the national debt works is whenever the government figures out their budgets or whatever, and they're like, okay, we're gonna spend $10 trillion on the military or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like the government just writes a check because what the government goes to the military and then the military goes to all their private contractors, right?
Mm. Exactly. And so Raytheon gets their buku dinero.
Yeah. And so what happens is in my mind, the government just writes this big old check, you know, of fake money. Essentially,
like a sweepstakes check.
Yeah. Essentially, to these private contractors, mm-hmm. directly from the government that is just immune to inflation, right? Mm. Because the government says this is money that we agreed needs to be spent. Mm. So we can just, because it's like, where does the government get that money? The government get that, like, it's like, oh, the government spending is what adds to the national debt. And so the national debt is just all of this money that we've agreed is not going to contribute towards inflation, right? And if it's like, it's currently what, like more money than is in the entire world currently? Yeah. Like there's literally not enough currency in the entire world to pay off the United States national debt. And it's like, so it's like, I don't know, why don't we just forget about, why don't we just not do inflation?
Yeah. I this has been a trick, boys. This episode's actually the weirdness of currency. Yeah! We finally did it.
We did it, boys. We got it. Within the episode. All right, but continue about
sure. Let's
about
let's get
Ponzi.
Back into Ponzi's good yeah. old that good old
that
boy
was a
scheme.
Fun little tangent, but
not entirely inapplicable to this nonsense that Ponzi was pulling here, but like yeah. So Ponzi began depositing the money in the Hanover Trust Bank of Boston, which was a small bank in on Hanover Street in the mostly Italian North End of Boston,
in the hope that
once his account was large enough, he could impose his will on the bank or even be made president of it.
He went and bought
a controlling interest in the bank through himself and several friends after depositing $3 million in it.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so by July of 1920, the same year while all this is going down, Ponzi made millions and people were mortgaging their homes and investing their life savings into the SCC. Most did not take their profits, but reinvested that money to try to make even more. So Ponzi's company, meanwhile, had set up branches from Maine to New Jersey. So now he has multiple branches of this security exchange company doing this Ponzi scheme. So now here's where it starts to get things start to not look so good for Ponzi.
Oh, geez.
So even though Ponzi's company was bringing in fantastic sums of money each day, the simplest financial analysis would have shown that the operation was running at a huge loss. As long as money kept flowing in, existing investors could be paid with the new money. This was the only method Ponzi had to continue providing returns to existing investors, as he had made no effort to generate legitimate profits.
AKA, there's no supply, no demand.
Exactly.
Like, there's no actual business being run here.
Yeah, there's no nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just fucking people keep investing and keep taking that investment money and then just giving it away to people.
It's magical money.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. So, though Ponzi was still paying back investors, mostly from money from subsequent investors, he had not yet figured out a way to actually change the IRCs into cash.
Oh, no!
Which is a huge problem for his system.
That's a big part of the scheme here. Come on, Ponzi.
The exchange rate, but the thing is, you can't really sell them, per se, as much as, like, you know, you just get that value, that added value in IRCs in the other country. So it's like, okay, yeah, so you can buy it at a cheaper price, say, in France and exchange it in America for more IRCs because it's more, the value is different, but you don't get actual money
for it. So what you're saying is you just got to send
IRCs.
You got to send lots and lots and lots of mail to make it worth it. Basically.
Exactly, but yeah, exactly.
No, it's never worth it. It's like
you're never gonna get actual money.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like somebody
it's
being
just
like
a value. It's like a coupon. It's like
it's like I got $20 billion worth a little frog statue. I'm
no,
rich.
It's basically it's funny that it's called an IRC because it's basically the NFT of the 1920s.
Yeah. Oh no,
there's no actual value here besides the value. But even it's almost worse though because you could still pay money. And someone could still buy that NFT from you, I guess, and give you real money for it.
Yeah.
In this case, there's really nothing. You could just give your money for the IRC, and then you just have an IRC now.
That's hilarious.
You know?
Yeah.
So the only thing you can get with that IRC is potentially more IRCs in a country where the value is different. So he also subsequently realized that changing the coupons to money was a logistical impossibility. So, for example, for the initial 18 investors of January 1920, for their $1,800 investment, it would have taken 53,000 postal coupons to actually realize the arbitrage profits. So that's how many of those coupons he would have needed to actually like pay back.
The
$1,800 in investments they made.
Because they're worth like not that much each.
They're worth cents. And
he's got like millions of dollars worth of investments.
Oh yeah. So So for subsequent 15,000 investors that Ponzi had, he would have needed to fill a Titanic-sized ships, plural, ships,
oh, no,
with postal coupons just to ship them to the United States from Europe in order to achieve this scam.
God, that is so funny.
Oh, he must have realized this just like in one moment, and he's just like, oh, shit.
I mean, the word, like, clearly nobody knew, like, people just thought he was an investment firm, right? Like, yeah. They didn't know basically that his plan was to supply all the money with that post.
Right. Well, right, only like the very like OG people maybe knew that like that's like how this whole thing worked.
Well, and at that point, like, it was kind of working because, like you said earlier, the earlier you are in the scheme, the earlier you can get out with a profit.
Well, no, I'm saying is he's not explaining how he's just presenting it as a standard investment firm, and only the because anyone who when you explain that to someone, if you were to explain where the money's coming from to these investors, they're gonna be like, what? How are you gonna do that?
Yeah,
that you can't ship millions and millions and millions and millions of those little of those IRCs, and then they'd be like, no, I'm not gonna invest in that.
So I just wonder if like the first like 30 people like were fully aware that this was not going to work, and they were like, we're basically stealing money from the smaller investors here.
Yeah, I highly doubt those people realized that. I'm sure like he like had a way of like selling the original idea to people to make it sound like, oh, you know, like it's like a perfect system. Yeah. I you know, do this thing where I get these things and I sell them at a profit here, and then we just keep money coming in, boys.
It's,
you know,
like a perpetual motion machine. They really work.
Yeah, so I'm sure like once you get into those later thousands of investors, they have no clue what this whole thing is based off. They just like hear like, oh, people are investing their money in this place and they're getting the buco dividends. So like,
why not
get in on the game, fellas? Mm-hmm. So obviously, as this scheme starts to, you know, start to lose its steam, if you will, because they're running out of people to find to invest in this thing. The Boston Post starts doing an investigation into his company, which is, you know, sort of like a local newspaper of the time, being like, how is this whole Charles Ponzi's business, the security exchange company, even work? So they start doing like some investigative journalism into their practices and stuff, and very quickly unravel the fact that this is all a big fucking scam and is literally being funded just by people investing their money, and their money's literally just being used to pay other people.
Now, I hope this isn't a spoiler of later in the episode, but this is literally Jordan Belfort. Like, this is the exact same thing as the Wolf of Wall Street storyline.
Now, the funny thing is I did not end up doing anything for that one. I felt like that could be its own episode.
Oh, frankly, totally.
Charles Ponzi himself could have his own episode. He's going to be the majority of this episode because, I mean, the man's the OG, so we really got to spend some time on him.
Yeah, yeah. But, and he's dapper, too. Like, I'm looking at pictures of him right now. The guy looks like Willy Wonka.
Yeah, people don't dress like that anymore. Man, they really knew how to dress back in the 20s. Proper gentleman.
Dude, these Zoomers with their freaking hype beast and their... thrifted.
Now, to be fair, Bobby, that's like a colorized image. I know. I think they made him to look like
he looks
Willy
like Willy Wonka on purpose.
Now Bob.
But yeah, no, it's funny because like I watched Wolf of Wall Street somewhat recently, which is a great movie, and it is basically, if you don't know, it's the same thing. It's like they're telling everybody to invest in these penny stocks, and then they take the money that people invest in the penny stocks and basically just take it and pay themselves. It's like, it's an interesting scheme, but this is pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, so obviously as the Post like basically unravels the fact that, you know, Charles Ponzi is, you know, just running a scam, and they find out about the scams he ran when he was living in Canada, they're like, okay, so this guy is just a fucking con artist. And so very soon afterwards, you know, he has two federal indictments against him with 86 different charges of mail fraud, and was facing life imprisonment.
Oof.
But was convinced to plead guilty on November 1st of 1920 and was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison, which is not very long. And then he ended up getting out and living. Yeah, he ended up living the rest of his life like down in Florida or something.
He's lucky, man. He's lucky he made it out of that one. I mean,
but that's
so who gave all the people their money back? Like what do you
They just lost their
you
money.
You just lose your money in that?
Yeah, I know. Literally, this whole scheme, literally at the end of it, collapsed five banks in the United States because of how much fraudulent money was being invested in or being deposited into these banks from this scam. So they like lost all that money, and like five different banks just like went under as a result of all this. So,
makes you wonder if the same thing will happen with like crypto and NFTs.
I don't know, man.
Like, if everyone cashed out their crypto right now in the world, is there enough money to pay all that? Like,
maybe. I mean, ask that of any.
Fiat currency. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, any. Yeah. 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 Any fiat currency. I don't think there's. I don't think there's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why. Yeah, that's why people don't trust banks or whatever, right?
Yeah. I keep all my money in a hole cut out of my mattress, man.
Yeah.
At the bottom of it.
I keep all my money like underground in gold bars.
Exactly. Ooh, along with my handgun when shit goes down.
It's inconvenient. It's inconvenient when I need to go to like buy Dunkin's coffee though, because I have to like dig a hole just to get my.
You have to dig a hole and you gotta, you know, threaten your neighbors real quick and say, stop looking into my yard. I will shoot you.
Stop looking into my yard.
You're infringing on my rights. You know, it's just the whole thing. It's tiring. It's tiring. Who's got time for that these days?
I understand. I feel it.
All right. So that's the story
that was great.
Of one Charles Ponzi.
That was way more interesting than I expected it to be, honestly.
So the next one here is about a man named Gregor MacGregor.
No way.
Gregor MacGregor, Scottish. He's a Scottish fellow.
Gregor MacGregor.
Gregor MacGregor, otherwise known as the Fake Prince.
I don't know. Ooh, I feel like Gregor MacGregor is a better nickname than the Fake Prince, Gregor. Come on, dude.
Right. So, Gregor MacGregor was a Scottish soldier, adventurer, and confidence trickster, otherwise known as a grifter, who attempted from 1821 to 1837 to draw British and French investors and settlers to Poyais, I don't know how to pronounce it, a fictional Central American territory that he claimed to rule as Caique, which is a Spanish or Portuguese. This place was like supposedly around Venezuela, so I'm not exactly sure the actual language, but Caique means prince in that language. Hundreds of people invested their savings in supposed Poyaisian government bonds and land certificates, while about 250 people emigrated to MacGregor's invented country between 1822 and 23.
What?
To find only an untouched jungle where more than half of them died.
What?
Oh my God.
Seen as a contributory factor to the Panic of 1825, which I didn't actually look up what that is, so look it up yourselves, you nerds. I don't know what that is. MacGregor's Poyais scheme has been called one of the most brazen confidence tricks in history. So,
just a bold-faced lie.
He just made up a country that he was became made prince of.
He just knowingly sent people. He was like, "Yeah, dude, there's a whole country there, and
we got a whole settlement here for you guys. Come on, just buy some land bonds. We got a place for you. We'll get you set up real good. We'll find you like a nice. You can get you set up in your cobbler shop or do whatever the fuck you're doing down in Poyais in 1822.
This guy must have been great at accents, or people back then must have just been so dumb.
Well, here's the thing. So let me tell you a little bit about this guy. So MacGregor was a successful officer and general in the Scottish Army. Are part of the UK army, because at that point Scotland is a part of the United Kingdom. So
at that point, as well,
technically yes, it's still part of that. But you know, there was a time when Scotland was separate. This is not one of those times. Scotland is part of the United Kingdom by this
Scotland
time.
Scotland forever.
Yeah.
I'm aware.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So this guy McGregor was basically like a general in their army and was a very successful general in the Venezuelan War that took place in the early 1800s. So he sort of like made him a name for himself as this like really well-regarded general who won many like key battles in this Venezuelan War of, you know, English imperialism. So like he like was like an OG fucking imperialist down there in Venezuela, just like running shit. And so after the war was
OG imperialist.
Hell yeah, bruv. And so once that war was over, on his return to Britain in 1821, McGregor claimed that the King George Frederick Augustus of the Mosquito Coast in the Gulf of Honduras had created him or made him into Caique Apoyes, which he described as a developed colony with a community of British settlers off the Mosquito Coast near the Gulf of Honduras. When the British press reported on McGregor's, he tells, you know, the monarchy this, they're like, oh, that's great. You know, good for you, buddy. Go be prince of fucking place. Yeah, we'll send you some money and stuff. That's total. Yeah, that's V chill, dude. Like, do it up.
That's V chill.
So, of course, eventually, like, the people figured out this was all kind of a scam. So when the British press reported on McGregor's deception following the return of fewer than 50 survivors of the 250 people who went to the jungle and just died out there because they thought there was going to be a colony in late 1823, some of his victims actually leaped to his defense, insisting that the general had been let down by those whom had put him in charge of the emigration party. So basically, like, he like also like conned these people into thinking that like, oh, these people, you know, people who are supposed to be, you know, helping us emigrate to the colony just fucked up and got us lost. And, you know, that's why, 200 people died. It's not because
there was no country there.
Right. It's because these fucking guides messed up. You know, they probably did it on purpose because of the Venezuelan War, if we're being honest. kind of crazy. But a French court eventually tried McGregor and three others who were part of the scheme for fraud in 1826 after he attempted a variation of this scheme elsewhere, but was convicted only of one, but only one of his associates was convicted. He was actually acquitted of all these crimes he was charged of with this scam and basically just kept like running different versions of this scam.
You think he acted as his own lawyer?
I'm sure he did. It's like what's that Jack Nicholson movie, that you can't handle the truth movie, you know?
Yeah, except the courtroom are the legitimately can't handle
the yeah truth. They literally cannot comprehend the truth.
so he just lies to him and he got acquitted.
Yeah, so basically he just kept running the scam until eventually he moved it to Venezuela and just like lived out his life there, where people there actually like worshiped the guy and like thought he was like, he got like military honors when he died in 1845 at age 58. So this guy was like died like a folk hero down there, even though he was basically just like a huge scammer and just like spent his whole life after like participating in this Venezuelan war just like conning people. So like it's almost like the Venezuelans like almost like embraced him as like someone who was just conning like the British Empire.
That's so
funny.
You
know? So that's kind of the story of that guy. Just fucking dude who's just like, I love, I'm just gonna make my McGregor own country.
I love that. I mean, I wish he didn't get 200 people killed, but that's so funny that he was just like, yeah, dude, I'm the prince of this place over here.
Yeah.
Like he was probably just like, why not? I wish I could have met him. I bet he has such a funny attitude. I bet he's a great person to talk to. He must be.
Mm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He's definitely super interesting.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's so good, dude.
All right, so we're gonna do one more. I have a fourth one, but I don't have much for him. And frankly, there's a movie about him, Frank Abagnale. If you've ever seen Catch Me If You Can,
baby,
he's the Catch Me If You Can guy.
Yeah.
The main thing you need to know about him is actually like a lot of his story seems like really kind of like overblown by him, and maybe like completely made up certain aspects of it. But he was a well-known con guy from the 70s and did run some pretty amazing cons, which if you've seen that movie, you know about. So go watch that movie.
Great,
it's good.
Great movie. Great movie.
Actually, but, I have not seen it.
Oh, it's a good one.
That's a good. It's an underrated classic. Spielberg. Underrated Spielberg. That's a good one.
That's like a once every like 3 years movie, you know?
Yeah, Tom Hanks of his like ridiculous Boston accent he's doing.
I talk like this. It sounds on Tom like a Boston accent.
He's trying to do Boston accent in that movie.
Frank Abagnale.
Come on, Frank.
You got to come with me.
Frank Abagnale.
Frank Abagnale.
Don't you want to spend Christmas with your family? Like, what are you
it's
doing,
It's goofy as
Tom?
All get out, but... Yeah, no, it's goofy as all get up, but Tom Hanks, he's adorable, so...
He's very cute.
You go with it, so...
He's the sweetheart.
But the last guy I'm going to talk about, because we're approaching an hour now, is one George C. Park.
Mm.
So, let me tell you a little bit about George C. Park. So, George C. Park was an American con man best known for his repeated successes selling the Brooklyn Bridge... Hence
what?
Your Brooklyn Bridge B, Brent.
Oh! So, now I wish I did that one.
So.
How would I have known?
George C. Parker made his living conducting illegal sales of property he did not own. Often New York's public landmarks.
Is this like selling awesome. Stars?
that is literally like selling stars, yeah, except like... Hey, you want to buy the Statue of Liberty?
Like,
we should do that. Dude, let's sell like funny. I'm gonna sell Mount Everest.
Yeah, I'm gonna sell Central Park to you boys.
Okay,
you know, at a steal, at a discount.
Yeah.
Bro, can you imagine how expensive Central Park would be?
Oh man.
Oh my God! In the heart of New York, dude.
If you were really committed, could you like?
It's right
say,
next to Central Park.
If you were like super committed, could you say like, I own like. Half the sun, because like one else has done that. So you could just be like, I own it.
I own
everyone.
The backside of it.
I own
the backside of it. You don't side the part you don't see.
The backside. I own the backside. I own the dark half of the sun. Actually.
Oh yeah, the dark dark side of the sun.
I actually own the dark side of the sun.
Okay, Lord Steven.
I wonder if you could if you could force the United States government to make a legal declaration on the ownership of a celestial object.
Mm-hmm. What about like clouds? Like could you buy a bucket of water and like throw it in the air and be that's my cloud, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm gonna rip a fat cloud.
Oh, there you go.
Vape Nation.
If you buy the jewel pods, and you technically own that cloud.
I own that.
Good one. Dude, good one.
Brent, you owned some clouds last night,
that's
bro.
A fucking fat clouds, bro.
I own this cloud, and I hereby declare it Vape Nation.
Yeah.
Good one.
So,
but
great one, Bob. Great one, Bob. So. Basically, he was finding like unwary immigrants who like had moved to New York and like convincing them that he owned these landmarks and trying to sell them to him. So the Brooklyn Bridge was the subject of several of his transactions predicated on the notion of the buyer controlling access to the bridge. So basically, I'd be like, yo, I own this bridge. You know, I could sell it to you. You can make some toll booths, get some tolls, make some cash. What do you think? I'm taking a bath on this sale, Franklin, here. I just need to offload this bridge to you. What do you think? So, he did this several times, which caused police to have to remove several of his victims from the bridge as they tried to erect toll booths onto the Brooklyn Bridge.
That's so embarrassing.
Yeah. So, Parker was basically convicted of fraud three times as a result. After one arrest around 1908, he escapes a courthouse by calmly walking out after donning a sheriff's hat and coat that had been set down by a sheriff who had walked in from the cold outdoors. Like, this is like some cartoon shit. Like,
that is like Catch Me If You Can, yeah.
Yeah, that really is like Catch Me If You Can.
Just pick up a sheriff's coat and hat and just walk out.
Yeah. Dang.
And it fucking works.
Wow.
It's kind of amazing. After his fourth conviction on December 17th of 1928, he was sentenced to a mandatory life term at Sing Sing Prison by Judge Alonzo C. McLaughlin in the Kings County Court. He spent the last 8 years of his life incarcerated there and was popular among guards and fellow inmates who enjoyed hearing of his exploits. Parker is remembered as one of the most successful con men in the United States history, as well as history's most talented hoaxers. So, just fucking selling New York landmarks to unsuspecting immigrants.
Whereas, like, Robert Durst, like, could actually do this. And instead, he's like, I'm just gonna go kill people. Like,
yeah, I'm gonna chop up my neighbor's body because he knows who I am. I'm gonna shoot my best friend in the head.
Yeah. Instead of like selling his like iconic landmarks and buildings that he owns in New York. Yeah, this is an interesting one. I mean, like, it really does make you think about like those dumb like little things you'd buy as a kid. Like, you own the Comet A46B, and it's like, I own the Comet. And it's like, how many other weird alien children own that same Comet? Like, you know,
bro, how do those like what there? I mean, there is like the new form of that. There's that company that will make you a lord.
Mm.
But I think that one is a little bit more tangible than the Comet one. 'Cause apparently all you need to be a lord is to own land in like a certain part of England or something.
So it could be like a microscopic piece of land.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a company that will sell you a square foot of land, and they do it like for every square foot of land they donate, the square foot that you buy is like a protected wildlife area. Right, and they don't, and they they're planting trees and stuff, and so then you like legally can be a lord, which I also don't understand because as far as I know, in America you can't use honorifics, but like on your passport, on your credit card, it can say like lord, you know, Lord Robert Briggs.
Oh man,
Lord Robert Briggs III. That's adds a nice ring to it, gotta say. Yeah. But so you're telling me, Jack, if I do this, I can't like also hire a serf to work that square foot of land for me?
I think you might be granted a serf by the king.
Oh, okay. Comes with the purchase.
Yeah. The serf. The serfs are tied to the fief, man. All right. That's how it was back then. All right.
Exactly.
I am technically an ordained minister.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So you guys can do that if you want to as well.
Yeah. Nice.
What were you saying about apartments, Brent, before I...
I was just gonna make some dumb joke about my fiefdom. You know, I got a nice apartment. You know, I can get Whole Foods deliveries sent to them to my serf. As part of my fiefdom. I take good care of my serf. All right.
Oh my gosh, but guys, anyway, I say dumb. We all become lords.
Oh fuck yeah, dude!
I think
the only podcast that has three lords hosting it. Are you serious?
We'll just call it Brain Boggled with L, L, and L.
Feeling good on a Wednesday.
Sparkling. Feeling good on a Wednesday, I am Lord.
Braineth boggled.
Oh, that was a fun episode. Holy crap.
Yeah, I had fun doing that one. I'm not going to lie, it took me until probably about 11 o'clock last night to decide that's what I was talking about. But I had fun with that one. That was a good time.
It was a good time. That brightened my day.
I hope everyone else enjoyed those famous griffs from history. If you want to hear other shit we've talked about, you know, maybe hit that subscribe button on the podcast when whatever you listen, so you can get these episodes every time they drop every other Monday. But
for like 3 years, we've been doing this
it'll be 3 years. What, in April next year, 2022?
Like in March,
fuck, dude.
April, March, one of those months, one of those times. Yeah.
It's crazy.
This is springtime. Thus the trees are born. So was this podcast.
Springtime.
Hitler. Well, guys, go check out that. Go check out our social meds. You can check out our non-existent memes that I always forget to post.
We got to remember to do one for this one, Squabbert.
Yeah.
We got a whole weekend.
Yeah, we got a long
weekend to make one.
I think we should just take this picture of Ponzi, Mr. Ponzi, and we'll put your face on
it. Yeah, just slap my face on there, my guy.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that.
Done. Also, go check out our website, brainbogglepodcast.com. You can find other of our episodes there. You can find our social meds there. You can find our Brain Bloggled, which has visuals and reference links and stuff to check out from each episode that we have them for. So there'll probably mostly be links for this one if you guys want to check out and read up more on one Charles Ponzi or Arthur MacArthur or Gregor McGregor, whatever his goddamn name was.
Gregor McGregor.
George C. Walker, you know, any of these guys, you want to read up more on them.
George R. R. Martin, the ultimate.
George R. R. Martin.
Grifter. Ewan McEwan.
Yeah, let's talk about some serious freaking grifts, bro. Yeah, Elon Musk. Elon Musk. These grifters.
I'm a grifto.
I've been a grifter the whole time. Oh.
I'm going bankrupt. And so
allegedly,
are you.
We don't actually. It is not the official stance of Brain Boggle that Elon Musk is a grifter. Companies are probably.
But it is an official stance of Brain Boggle that George R. R. Martin is.
Yeah. So, yeah. He's an emotional grifter.
It's also the official stance that it's Elon Musk.
And it's time to go eat dinner, I think.
Yeah, I think it's that. And 5-star reviews if you can.
Yes.
If you haven't already, 5-star review.
Yes.
We appreciate it. So thank you for listening, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
And
love you.
Invest in my new IRC's company.
Yeah!
called Brentus Brandt.
It's called Mail Back and Forth Brentus for Brandt. Hundreds of years.
It's called Brent mails you soup once a month, but he never actually mails you the soup.
Aha, that's the scam right there. Mm-hmm. There we go. We got it. All right.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.